Today is Wednesday. Happy March 6, 2024. It's 2:40 in the afternoon. And this is John Williams. You found the Mincing Rascals podcast once again. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2. And don't forget, we broadcast portions of this on Saturday nights. The best of this conversation we are about to have will be broadcast. Pete's shaking his head now. He says, no, we got bumped. So it doesn't matter how good we are then today. Anyway, I'm on from 10 to 2, and we'll still do a pretty good podcast for you. Share us with your friends. Give us a good rating. We'd like to grow our little Mincing Rascals community.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now writing the Chicago History website, Roseland Chicago 1972 on Substack.
I'm Austin Berger from the Illinois Policy Institute. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way.
John Hansen, WGN Radio and Block Club Chicago.
Eric Zorn, the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a fine Substack newsletter.
One quick postscript to start the show today, guys. Last week, we talked about the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that IVF clinics cannot destroy embryos. Constitutes wrongful death of a minor, they say. And Eric was confounded. I think I've got this right in my memory, Eric, by the right's position on this and other right-to-life issues, concluding that conservatives in power don't like us having recreational sex. And I challenged that. I thought that was kind of a bizarre observation. And yet there's Rolling Stone in a recent piece they posted last month titled, "The Right is Cracking Down on Abortion and IVF. Is Recreational Sex Next?" They quote a right-wing activist who said that conservatives have to lead the way in restoring sex to its true purpose and ending recreational sex and the senseless use of birth control pills. You know, you can find somebody on the internet that says anything. So I'm not sure that some conservative activist gives that all the juice it needs. But, Eric, I thought I would acknowledge that at least there's a little further validation out there to your observation about that.
Well, it makes sense to me when you think about some of the exceptions that a lot of people who are in the anti-abortion movement are willing to make. They're willing to make exceptions for rape and incest, for instance, many of them. What sense does that make unless you're seeing pregnancy as the consequences of sex, not for procreation? Something that I've always thought that the animating feature of the anti-abortion movement is not this overwhelming concern with multi, you know, tiny cellular life or even fetal life. It has more to do with controlling women and controlling sexual activity that's not meant for procreation. It just seems to me to all add up. And that explains why it's the conservative movement that is so strongly aligned with the anti-abortion movement as opposed to other movements. That to me is very telling. But I think Chris Rufo is a major voice on the right. I mean, he's way out there, but he is well respected and well followed by a lot of people. So I don't think this is an inconsequential observation. I also would challenge all the people who are nodding their heads at what Chris Rufo is saying. How many of them have sexual relations that are not for procreative purposes? Has Chris Rufo never had sex? Does he not have sex for fun anymore? Is it all just because he only has sex when he wants to have babies? I'll bet that's not true.
I still live in the space of I don't care what you're doing in your private life, unless you're breaking a crime or cheating on your taxes, that I don't care. I don't even invest the energy to think or that you would worry about it or contemplate policies because of how other people are living their private lives is just too much work for me.
Certain conservatives want a government so small that it fits in your bedroom.
Well, isn't that ironic? I mean, I always thought conservatives were the ones that did not want to exert too much influence on our lives.
Well, doesn't it also explain their opposition to gay rights, too? It's always puzzled me, like, why would it bother? Why would it be any of their concern or business? It's not like we have this terrible problem that people aren't having enough babies.
Well, I mean, that's why you pretty much have to separate a social conservative from an economic conservative. And also, you know, to be realistic, who isn't hypocritical at some point? Certainly any conservative who wants to control what other people do in their bedroom is being hypocritical.
Right. Libertarians have been always very consistent on recreational sex and who you have it with and who you marry. But even on questions of abortion, that's split, right? Because they're all about autonomy and personhood and individual rights. And then the question comes down to, well, when does this fetus have individual rights and does it? So there's even cleavages there. It makes me sad that the conservative discussion on this is around recreational sex as such, rather than things like the success sequence, which is agreed to by Brookings Institute, all the way from Brookings Institute to Heritage to AEI. And it basically says, if you do these three things, there's a 97% chance that you will not end up in poverty. And the three things are high school education, full-time job, marry before having children. And that third one, there's a way that you can highly write code that statement, but there's also a way that you can say that in a way that's completely nonpartisan and is just something that needs to be talked about culturally, not in a shameful way or in a way that's doctrinaire or paternalistic, but it is in a way that is caring towards the outcomes of people and their futures, and that young men and women do better in life when they take sex seriously. And that shouldn't be like a conservative message.
How do you write code that last thing, Austin?
Recreational, basically what Rufo was saying, which is that recreational sex should stop. Rather than saying, hey, it's going to be much better for your life if you take pregnancy very seriously and try to get married before you have kids.
Or just be really aggressive about birth control. That would do that too, right?
Absolutely. But I'm saying, how would you write code it? That's the way that...
Conservative write code it as opposed to correct write code it.
Can I add one more thing? I didn't want to just cast that it's only the far right that is hypocritical. I think Kate mentioned that too. The left doesn't want 14-year-olds to have to tell their parents about getting an abortion, but they have to get a permission slip to get an aspirin in school. I'm just saying that there's a lot of hypocritical thoughts we all weigh back and forth in terms of size of government, and it does go.
I don't know if it's hypocritical or inconsistent. I mean, Butcher, I'm not sure what the difference is between those two, but it's definitely true. And the idea should not be anathema that it's better to have a two-parent household, whether it's, you know, two men, two women, husband and wife. I mean, that seems to me to be solidly associated with good outcomes for people and encouraging that. But part of encouraging that, I think, is really being aggressive about contraception. You do see a lot of objections on the right to contraception. And what this Rolling Stone article that John talked about dealt with was the fact that there are some, there's some movement against IUDs and even the birth control pill, saying that they are in effect causing abortions because they're not allowing fertilized embryos to be implanted and so on. You know, I think stressing the importance of birth control is really important, and healthy practices in sex is really important. And I think that it's better to have nuclear families when you can have them. And by that, I mean, a couple of parents. But this busybody stuff about what's going on in your bedroom is just way beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I do think we are underestimating that there is a large part of this population in the United States that thinks that we are morally in a terrible place as a country, that we have moved so far away beyond the word of God that we are in peril and on a spiral towards destruction because of that. And that is not just a fringe opinion, I don't think. I think that a lot of conservative people believe that.
Speaker of the House, right now, the Alabama Supreme Court Justice quoted the Bible at length along those lines, John.
So I think that you get a lot of policies that don't make sense, and we say, how could someone believe it? But if you are part of the belief that we are on a downward spiral, then you will try to reverse the trend to 1950 when they would say we weren't.
It really is too bad that the whole religious conservative argument against recreational sex, wanting to get into people's bedrooms, shaming people for potentially having kids out of wedlock gets in the way. I don't know if any of you have read any of the reviews of the Rob Henderson book that came out in the last couple of weeks, Troubled. It's super interesting. As somebody who grew up in the foster care system and just like barely escaped that, because apparently only like 3% of people who were ever in the foster care system managed to actually get to college. And he managed to do that and actually go to Harvard and then Oxford and get a PhD, blah, blah, blah. But this is one of the things that he talks about a lot. He's actually the one who invented the term luxury beliefs, which largely around this very issue, making the point that people who are educated, upper middle class, et cetera, will say, oh, marriage isn't important. That's, do what you want to do. It doesn't matter. But in fact, the people who come from two-parent families are the people who get ahead in life.
Is this book a memoir or a series of essays? What is it?
Yeah, it's a memoir. It's a memoir describing his childhood and how he managed to get out of all that, initially by getting into the army and then eventually going to college, and just like how crazy it was for him to come from his background to being with people in the Ivy League, et cetera.
He's not another J.D. Vance, is he? Because that,
you know what? He's kind of like J.D. Vance if J.D. Vance hadn't gone all crazy, evil Trumper.
I'm not sure J.D. Vance was crazy when he wrote Hillbilly Elegy.
No, I mean,
gone crazy.
So well, I suppose Rob Henderson could go crazy at some point in the future. He hasn't yet.
Nothing surprising has happened on the national scene since we last gathered. The Super Tuesday results and Nikki Haley's dropping out of the race were to be expected, and the Supreme Court ruling that Donald Trump should be on the ballot, not because he didn't lead an insurrection, but because the state doesn't have the power to eliminate him from contention, especially for the office of the presidency, was a 9-0 decision.
I thought it was an interesting decision. I kind of thought it would be 9-0, and it was, not to try and pat myself on the back, but I think anyone who was reading the tea leaves of the oral arguments, I think they got it right. I don't necessarily agree with the majority's sense that Congress has to be the one to mechanize this. It wasn't used that way in the past. I actually agree with the concurring opinion of Amy Coney Barrett, reading through her opinion, for charting a little bit more of a middle ground for how the 14th Amendment would actually be enacted. As for Super Tuesday, yeah, it's kind of what we thought. I think Nikki Haley's been saying she's got this 40% number in her head, and she came well under that. You take the entire popular vote of all the states voting, with still a lot of California left to come in, and she got roughly 24% of the voters. A lot of people like to say that, oh, well, a lot of her voters, and you see this in exit polls, 2 out of 3 of her voters will not vote for Donald Trump. And there's something to be said about that, but the majority of people, maybe not the majority, but a very sizable part of people that were voting for Nikki Haley either didn't vote in 2020 or voted for Joe Biden. They are not Trump voters that he has lost that came out for Nikki Haley. I would imagine very few of them are. So I don't know what we can read from it. The national polls are the national polls. I don't think that there's some really quiet Joe Biden support that is just being missed by pollster after pollster. It's a tied race. It's March 6th. Where do we go from here? I mean, it's tied, essentially.
What is the mechanism that Congress should enact? If the 14th Amendment means anything, it should mean something about Donald Trump. Supreme Court said that states don't have the power to eliminate that federal candidate off the ballot. What does Congress need to do? What do they need to say to enable us to use the 14th Amendment?
Today, the legal experts don't really know. When Eric was complaining about how long the judges take just to hear arguments and then come up with a ruling when it's something that's really important and urgent, what I was thinking is the flip side of that is how annoying it is when they finally do it, they come up with their ruling, and then it's something where everybody still goes, so what does that mean? What do we do now? There's a real question if Trump gets elected, and I hate to say it, but I think that's inevitable now. Could Congress, I saw that look on your face, John, so I'm sure we'll talk about that too. But if he gets elected, let's say if, could Congress decide not to okay the election results? If he gets elected, we're guaranteed to just have it just be a complete brouhaha.
I don't think there'll be a brouhaha, because I don't think there's a chance in hell that Congress, if you're talking about the Senate and the House, would vote to overturn the results of an election. I mean, they couldn't even impeach Trump with two really good opportunities to do so before. So I don't see that happening at all. I've always thought all along in the story that the 14th Amendment thing on insurrection was very strangely worded, and it was like we all understood what it meant. But John's question is really important, which is who decides? I mean, you can't just say, I mean, there's like a, say the Constitution, talk about the constitutional threshold of age. You got to be 35 years old to be president. Okay. That's a yes and no, black and white question. You're either that age or you're not, or you're either a citizen of the United States, a born citizen, or you're not. That does not require a vote of anybody. But an insurrection is almost a legal verdict, and someone has to make that verdict. And I agreed with this panel before about this, that it was very dangerous and dicey for us to have individual states making this decision, saying like Colorado and then Illinois saying oh, we can't be on the ballot, and that just opens the door for, you know, North Dakota to say, well, then Biden's not on the ballot because we don't like how he pulled out of Afghanistan, and that was insurrectionist, or, well, you know, whatever. The possibilities for mischief were endless. So I think it's good that there's a central deciding figure, and maybe it should have been the courts instead of Congress. Maybe it's not a political decision, but it's a legal decision.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why it's going to be a complete crazy brouhaha, because Congress isn't going to do anything. The trial could be going on during the end of the election, could be continuing to go on after the election.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to apply to Donald Trump in any way, shape, or form. Congress needs to set up the mechanism for which this is applied in the future. And I think that's ultimately the decision that is the right. It is a decision that can be made, barring someone being charged by a jury of their peers with insurrection as a crime, which, by the way, is not one of the 91 indictments against Donald Trump in any way, shape, or form. So I think we're always left with judicial decisions that say, well, not this way, but Congress has to figure it out. The judiciary essentially saying that, like many laws, the Constitution is a guiding principle, and Congress now needs to federalize some laws to analyze the implementation of it. It just hasn't really come up since they instituted this amendment in the late 1860s, except for a few smaller cases or a few involving judges.
It's sure. Just, and we'll live the rest of our lives without having it be needed ever again, I would wager.
Maybe.
The irony is that if they do craft those laws and you did have a case, Trump would be found guilty on it. And I think too much attention is focused on January 6th and should be focused on maybe his calls to Mike Pence before January 6th or his calls to Raffensperger. An insurrection doesn't have to be a physical act. It can be done in boardrooms and over telephones and in meetings with people. That, right? It doesn't have to be charging up to the Capitol.
We have the law of insurrection on the books. He's not being charged with insurrection or aiding insurrection. We have conspiracy. We have racketeering in the Georgia case. But we don't. He's not being charged with insurrection. There is a law about insurrection. He's not being charged with that, though, which I think weakens the case for people saying that he should be barred from running, because he hasn't been charged with insurrection nor found guilty by someone as being an insurrectionist.
Yeah, that's true.
Why didn't we charge him with insurrection? Why
it's a pretty high bar.
Well, you don't. Do you think he was insurrection? Do you think he would be found guilty of insurrection, John? Do you think he was an insurrectionist?
I certainly think he moved the needle on it. And that's probably as polite as I can put it. I definitely think he fanned the flames of insurrection. I'd have to read the statute of what, like, insurrection is. A couple of the Proud Boys, I believe, were charged with insurrection and found guilty of that. I don't know. I'd have to read more about it. I hate to punt on that, John, but it's true.
I appreciated what Eric was saying on his Picayune Sentinel this week, that there is one theme that kind of comes up locally and nationally, and that is the desire that judges would act more quickly. So on some of the things that we need decisions on, it would be nice if it happened quicker rather than later. We do have in front of me here the session beginning April 15th for the Supreme Court of the United States, October term 2023. It says here for the session beginning April 15th of this year, 2024, the court will take up six cases, and the very last of them, the sixth, will be seven cases, and the last of them will be Trump versus the United States, and that will be about presidential immunity.
I usually have a deep level of discomfort whenever I hear people being like, we need to have rulings quicker, right? Because I literally picture myself in Salem when witch trials are happening, and these are like taking forever. We all know they're witches, like, just drown them in the river, right? Like, there's a good reason for the gears of justice to grind slowly. That's important. However, in this case, when you have like, are they taking six or seven cases? You have six or seven slots, and you can decide whether to put one first or last. And I do, in that context, I don't understand why something like that would be last of the bunch. You would think it would be maybe that in the first two issues in terms of its importance and urgency.
It's weird to me that the Supreme Court would want to protect Donald Trump, because if Donald Trump takes over the way it seems like he wants to take over, the Supreme Court will be completely irrelevant. That we'll have a dictator, we'll have an autocrat, and with the Supreme Court will make a ruling and he'll just thumb his nose at it. I would hope that there would be enough people, enough esteemed, experienced judges on the Supreme Court that they would see what's happening here and want to resolve this and wouldn't want Trump to be reelected. I mean, I know it's a highly partisan body now, but it just seems it baffles me that the Supreme Court isn't more objective, neutral, and protective of the Constitution and protective of the country than they seem to be. Because this does seem to be a delay that's designed to push Donald Trump's trial, his major trial, back after the election. And that just seems preposterously partisan to me.
Oral arguments on the 25th. They start on the 15th in this session. So by 10 days, they could have moved it up. And they could have moved it up a lot more than that.
I can't believe they took the case. To be perfectly frank, I don't think this case deserved cert or even being heard before the Supreme Court. It is and I think they're going to rule 9-0 or 8-1 against immunity. I think they will rule ultimately against the former president. It's such an open and shut case that I feel like it didn't even need to be opened in the United States Supreme Court. It was decided, but 3-0, the appellate court slammed it to the ground, which seems inappropriate. I will say that I also like when things don't go super, super fast. I appreciate that. But Bush v. Gore was decided the day after oral arguments. And that was a 5-4 decision that, of course, ended the recount in Florida. Now, maybe you could argue that we were coming up against electoral college votings in the next weeks or two after that. But the Supreme Court can move faster when they want to. And the fact that they didn't hear is telling.
What would they need more time to make up their minds? What will they discover between now and sometime in May or June that they don't already know? I don't know if it involves them sitting in quiet rooms, contemplating, scratching their chin, muscling out the thought that is necessary to come to the right constitutional decision.
Maybe it waits till the end of June when they release the rest of the opinions of the court. 88 days, Judge Chunkin says she's going to wait between then. So June, July, August, September. It starts at the end of September at the earliest. You've effectively delayed it past the election or really close to it.
They want to give Clarence Thomas as long as possible to figure out that he should be recusing himself.
All of these decisions should be 8-0, not 9-0. Go ahead, Eric.
It's also baffling to me that it takes so much time from the time that, say, they make this decision. Say they decide in the last day of their session in June. They should be able to start the trial the next day, for that matter. I mean, these lawyers have had months and months and months to prepare. Everybody knows the issues. Everybody's briefed all up the wazoo on this. They could start that trial immediately, but the courts take so damn long on everything. How long does it take when they're not going to sentence Burke? All these people who aren't going to be sentenced for a long time, there's all these delays between times people are charged, and I know that lawyers need to prepare and so on, but length of the delays in our court system from the federal courts and the county courts is just unpardonable. It takes so long to get things done, and I just don't know, are our judges not working hard enough? Are our lawyers not working hard enough? It certainly looks that way. You look at this case down in Georgia, the case with Fannie Willis, the attorney, and the judge in that case, who's heard all the evidence, says he'll decide in 2 weeks. Like 2 weeks. He's been on this case for months already. He knows all the issues. Make a stinking decision. It's like he feels like he's got to, I don't know what he's got to do. He's got to write a big long thesis. He's got clerks to help him, I'm sure, or her. I think it's a man, though. And it's infuriating. All these things taking so long. The rest of us work a little faster than that.
At the Supreme Court, I picture them being kind of like a Jane Austen novel or a little Downton Abbey-ish, where they're all just, you know, very politely drinking their tea, and they never said they can't really say exactly what they really mean to each other. They all just have to be really polite. And so it takes like 2-3 weeks for even someone to say good morning to each other. I don't know what else to think.
Well, they must know what hangs in the balance, right? Austin said, you got seven slots there. I mean, you're going to have to go to work on Monday the 15th. You could have put it there. And about the bring Chicago home on the ballot and us all waiting for what the judges are going to say about that, producer Pete just handed me this. Bring Chicago home is back on the ballot after the city's appeal. So where we were waiting for a judge to make a decision on this, quoting from the decision, nothing in this decision is intended to suggest that we have any opinion one way or the other on the merits of the referendum at issue. That is a question wisely entrusted not to judges, but to the people of the city of Chicago. Austin, what did I just say here? What does all this mean?
So currently on all the ballots that have been printed, there is a question. And the question makes three changes to the tax code in Chicago. It slightly decreases the transfer tax for homes under $1 million, for all properties under $1 million when they're sold. It's called a transfer tax. It happens when you buy or sell property. It changes the tax rate. It increases it for properties between $1 million and $1.5 million, and then increases it a whole bunch for properties over $1.5 million. 2 weeks ago, a Cook County judge said that this question is unconstitutional and should not be counted. The ballots had already been printed. So people who said, like, it's off the ballot, that physically cannot happen, that's already on the ballot, we're not going to go through with like white out and go through the question.
Right.
The Board of Elections of the City of Chicago appealed that ruling and they just won on appeal. So as of today, the votes are going to count. As of yesterday, the votes were not going to count. Now, what happens next? The opponents could appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. And by the way, this last week, I would say this actually went pretty quickly. This appellate court ruling happened within like 1 or 2 weeks. But the election is in 13 days.
13 days. I disagree that. I mean, I know it's fast by judicial standards, but it took them 13 days. I mean, while people are out campaigning and spending money on this and wondering whether this thing's going to happen, wondering whether their votes are going to count, I don't know what they were doing for 13 days. It should have taken 2 days, and they're going to go to the Illinois Supreme Court. Now, I'm sure it's going to be appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court, and who knows how long they're going to take to make their ruling. It's like, get it done. No matter how you feel about this referendum, you want some finality. You want some certainty on the part of voters. I don't know what, if people have heard that it's not going to count and haven't voted one way or the other, which is unfair to the democratic process as well. So, yeah. It's infuriating. And the fact that this suit was filed in early January, January 5th, And it took the judge in Cook County like a month and a half to come to a decision. This is an urgent matter. I get when you have some sort of a theoretical legal question where everything is, you know, needs to be decided and researched to a fairly well. But this was an important matter, and they've just dragged their feet. And there's a lot of uncertainty in the electorate. I'm sure word will get out now that it's going to count, but maybe it won't because now it's going to be appealed. This is a legislative question. Is that how you read it, Austin? That the judges
were saying?
They're basically saying
this vote is just a part of the legislative process. So if we were going to intervene now, that would be like if, you know, in the Illinois House, they passed a bill and we stepped in before the Senate got to vote on it. This is just not the point for us to intervene. And that seems a little bit ridiculous to me because there are a limited number of slots for referendum questions on the Chicago ballot. Like, it is affecting people's decisions and ability to vote on different issues, the fact that this is even on the ballot. The other thing that's been really frustrating to me is after that initial decision, which said this is unconstitutional, you shouldn't have it. The reason for that, by the way, being that this is an example of log rolling, where you put a very popular thing, a small tax cut, in cahoots with a very unpopular thing, like a very large tax increase, sure, in the same question. And you could see how that power could be really abused and messed with to the point where it would really interfere with people's ability to make decisions about their government. And when that happened, the mayor and all the proponents of this said, this is voter suppression. This is Jim Crow. This is an affront to democracy. The real affront to democracy with this question is the fact that it's being decided in a primary election in Chicago. And that was done purposefully by proponents because fewer people vote in primaries. that allows people with a grassroots machine, aka CTU, United Working Families, SEIU, people who want this tax hike to pass, they get more power in low turnout elections. If they wanted as many people as possible to vote on this question, do it in a November election. Instead, they're doing it in a primary where the top of the ticket is already decided. And there's going to be probably 20% or lower turnout on this question in Chicago. So for
Eric,
to say that this is about democracy is ridiculous.
Eric, describe for us the log rolling, the sweetener, and how instead of one issue, this is three issues, maybe a couple of issues to try and get you to vote for something that you might not otherwise. And that made sense to me. I thought the logic, Eric, that you were presenting made sense and that a previous court ruled on. So I wonder what's changed here.
I thought Austin described it very well, which is you can't put a question to the voters saying, saying we want to increase taxes here, but lower taxes here. You're in effect sweetening the, you're giving them one question. You can't say yes. You can't say yes to the tax decrease, but no to the tax increase. And so putting a sweetener into the tax increase proposal is against the law, it's against state law. And they argue that it also violates the Illinois Constitution for, I thought it was sort of an arcane reason. But the principle of it seems right to me, which is like the council could easily have voted, as we said this before, they could have voted to lower the real estate transfer tax on whatever properties they wanted to. It's not required under state law for a municipality to get permission to lower a tax. In this case, they have to get permission to raise the tax on these upper income properties. And so to do that, they could have just put that on the question. They tried it. They tried twice to get that in front of the city council. They asked the council, can we put this on the ballot? And the city council said no twice. They said, no, you're not going to ask that question of the voters. When they added the sweetener, the tax decrease, then the city council said yes. And that's the objection that the people raise, which it sounds good to me. I don't know the law, and this idea that it's not part of the legislative process. When does the court step in then? If this is all a legislative question, the legislature is asked to decide. We've seen what we have in Springfield. They're not going to go against the mayor. They just folded in front of the mayor just this week on the whole elected school board issue. And I don't know exactly who steps in and when, but if they're waiting for the Illinois General Assembly to step in, they're going to wait a long time.
What I'm hearing here is that this decision is agreeing with the argument that basically it has to wait to become a law and then be contested. Austin made a wonderful point that, of course, it really should be at this point in the process because it's taking up a valuable position on the ballot. We can only have three of these questions. And of course, we all know that it's a very typical political strategy to pile things on a ballot to keep other referendum questions that they don't want on there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, if we're going to talk about what would be right democratically, why are we not allowing people to also have the referendum question of whether or not Chicago should be a sanctuary city?
They did not. They fought hard against putting that question on the ballot.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I cannot.
I'm just saying.
I cannot abide the preening of people who were opposed to that referendum on the sanctuary city, who are now carrying on about the people's right to be heard and the democratic process and people saying, oh, we're taking away the votes of the people and so on. I mean, that talk about an inconsistency. That is certainly one.
Well, is it possible that this will get voted for and then be deemed unconstitutional afterwards?
Very hard. When you get into like sort of legislative process arguments, that's a very hard, those are hard cases to win. The court is very, really deferential to the legislature, usually in those sorts of things. It's possible. I really do hope it's appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court and we get we get an opinion from the Illinois Supreme Court.
Well, is there polling on this, Austin? Do we know how people are going to vote on this?
Here's the reality. The primary electorate is so left skewed in Chicago, far greater left than the general election electorate, that opponents are fighting a really uphill battle for this. And even with that, I've seen recent polling that suggests it's within single digits. And that's mostly because of even among Democratic primary voters, they do not trust Brandon Johnson and they don't like his agenda. And the fact that he's attached to this means that they might not vote for it. So it's going to be really close. I would urge people to vote against it because the mayor has refused to release a plan. The mayor has refused, has failed to prove that he can adequately manage the city's budget and adequately manage priorities of competing special interests. And the city has lots of money ready that it's not spending addressing homelessness. So I think this will be a blank check, a slush fund, won't be managed well, and won't actually go really to help.
And will discourage businesses. And so then if you think about putting a business in Chicago and you know that when you sell that, you're going to have to pay a really steep tax, right? The building, the real estate. This is not just a little thing then, right? I mean, am I inflating the consequences of this?
There's real economic costs, but even setting those aside, it's the same thing of like, we're going to sell the parking meters and that's going to balance the budget for 50 years. Oh, wait, we spent the money in 2 years. Oh, all the lottery money is going to go to education. No, actually, none of the lottery money is going to go to education. If voters don't get a spending plan, you should vote no. That's the one accountability mechanism you have for how your money is spent. If they refuse to give you a plan, you shouldn't vote for higher taxes.
Well, he did run on this. I mean, bring Chicago home. I mean, maybe this is Brandon Johnson following through on his promise. He said, one of the reasons people voted for him, right, Austin, was for this very thing. I mean,
sure, some people.
He won the election, right?
He won the election. But remember, Brandon Johnson was elected by people who voted for someone else in the first round.
I know that.
So for them to go around saying that everything in Brandon Johnson's agenda is
an ethical mayor to do who gets elected on a campaign plank to do something? And then afterwards, what's he supposed to say? Well, but more people actually didn't vote for me or didn't want me as their first choice.
And I'm not necessarily saying Brandon Johnson shouldn't have advocated for this, period. His largest funder wanted this, and it's been a priority for them for a long time. So that I don't begrudge the mayor for pushing for this somewhat. I'm just saying that people should vote against it.
You know, since we're talking about that general issue, I don't have any problem with Brandon Johnson advocating for any policy at all that he said he was going to advocate for. But I do think it's really kind of arrogant when he presents so many issues like this as, well, of course I'm doing this. This is what I was elected to do. This is what people want me to do. That is an arrogant thing to say when you have been elected with no mandate. Austin has pointed out to us a couple of times now that he got a very, very small percentage in the initial election.
I don't think a winner should change their agenda based on how slim the margin.
No, I'm not saying he should. I'm not saying he should change it. I'm not saying he should change it, but he should not pretend that he has this gigantic mandate. He won by only 4%.
So what are you going to do with all that?
An incredibly tiny number of people.
So what's he supposed to do about that?
If I got elected and I knew that I had gotten elected by this incredibly tiny sliver, I would like to think that I would have the modesty to say, I understand not everybody was on board with everything that I advocated.
So you're going
to
break your campaign promise.
I want to sell this to you. You know, about this. And
example of this is it's about how that idea is implemented, right? So there's a way that you could go about keeping your campaign promise in a way that respects democracy in the city, right? I want to get everybody, he said this all during the campaign, right? I want to be one Chicago, a mayor for everybody. Oh yeah, by the way, my signature tax hike proposal, I'm going to try to get it passed when the fewest people possible vote. That's what he did.
I can't believe I'm even defending Brandon Johnson. I have disagreed with so many things that he has done. But when you win the election, you push as hard as you can to get as many things done as you can in the short time that you're in office. That's what the other team would do. That's what you do. And you fight for it as hard as you can. And if you don't, you likely lose re-election, and you might lose re-election anyways. I don't know. I used to be much more on the magnanimous side where you are, Kate, and, you know, just trying to bring everyone together and kumbaya and make things happen in a really polite way. But seeing what other politicians have done nationally, locally, man, when you got it, go for it. and you might lose because of it. But that's the way it works.
Yes, it's true. I will point out just real quickly that he advocated for a fully elected school board for years when he was a lobbyist for this for the Chicago Teachers Union. And now that he's mayor and has control of the school board, he's like, let's still keep me in control of the school board for a couple more years. So what he ran on and what he's doing in elected is not necessarily totally consistent. He was opposed to ShotSpotter. He renewed the contract once and then he extended it again for another 8 months, even though he said it was a useless technology. So let's not get too hung up on what he promised to do. But what we all knew when he was elected was that he was a former lobbyist, agitator, organizer for the CTU. And now we have the teacher contract negotiations coming up.
Yeah.
And Stacey Davis Gates this week came out very aggressively, basically saying she has a strong set of demands that she wants to make, and that if people ask how to pay for it, she said,
"Don't ask.
How are we going to?" She said, "Ask another question. Ask another question."
Yeah.
And I thought that this was a really, really, a really tone deaf response to what's going to be concerns from voters, which is, we like education, we support students, but we're not necessarily going to give in to every demand by the Chicago Teachers Union. And you're going to have Mayor Brandon Johnson negotiating with the people who put him in office.
Well, but he hasn't caved in on anything. I mean, here's where push comes to shove now, right? The concern was that he got elected because the CTU supported him. The question was, when their next contract came up, would he be able to divorce himself from his previous employer and just negotiate the best possible contract for everybody and not pay back to the CTU? And Stacey Davis Gates has now got a series of demands out that she describes as defiant. They run into the hundreds, and we don't know how this is going to go yet, right?
I just thought I'm really interested in Austin's take on this, but I just thought that the attitude that she took in her speech this week was so confrontational.
Well, it was Stacey Davis Gates, but go ahead.
Well, I know, but I mean, you got to say, look, I understand there are a lot of demands or a lot of budgetary problems that individuals have, individual families have, and that municipalities have, and the city of Chicago has a lot of urgent needs. And we want to prioritize these particular needs. But instead, she just basically comes out giving the finger to everybody, saying, and probably feels like, well, she's got Brandon Johnson on the fifth floor of City Hall. I mean, that was how I took it. I mean, I thought that the way she came on this week, the news reports about this were so off-putting. So it so much made me not want to be on the side of the teachers, where I usually am on some stuff like this. I just feel like, come on, these are tough economic times, and let's work together. Let's get a good deal for our kids and our teachers. But don't tell me that I can't ask where the money's coming
and there is
from
a deficit too.
CPS is staring down the barrel of over $300 million deficit next year. It goes over $600 million the year after that. That will be the biggest fiscal cliff that has probably ever been faced by the Chicago public schools. And to Eric's point, I mean, anyone can go look at the speech. It's on YouTube. It's just search City Club, Stacey Davis Gates. It's a pretty short speech. Listen to it on double speed. I don't know how anyone can watch that and feel confident in the governance of the city, because that person is the most powerful person outside of the mayor in the city of Chicago. And she was saying things that were so detached from reality, so ensconced in this militant, radical organizing model that has been built over 10 years in the Chicago Teachers Union. And it has nothing to do with the effective governance of a city or growing a city in the interest of all of its residents. The thing that stuck out to me was one of the most cavalier statements she made was first in the speech, she said what Eric said, which is everybody's going to say CTU's crazy. These demands are wild. Stacey, what are you doing? Where's this money going to come from? Ask a different question. And then just stops, like as if that's a profound thing to say. And then later in the speech, she says, guess what it's going to cost? $50 billion and 3 cents. Where's the Civic Federation Committee, right? Like, check me on that. That's what it's going to cost. And then she ended the speech. For context, $50 billion is what the entire state of Illinois takes in tax revenue.
She was being flip when she said that.
Yeah, she was out of a joke, right?
But then, she should say what the number is then, because businesses are looking to relocate to Chicago right now. And you have the second most powerful person in the city saying we want $50 billion. So tell them it's a joke. Like, that's a serious thing to say. If you're the leader of a city, you don't just get to do memes or like say things to be provocative. That has real costs for the city. Her tone has real costs for the city. And when she's pressed about that and she's asked questions as a powerful person in the city, you guys may have seen Marianne Ahern asked her several times, what was your role in the decision to stop the ShotSpotter contract? She asked her this three times. And at the end, Stacey Davis Gates said, I don't want to play into this idea that I'm a Lady Macbeth and that the mayor has no brains. I'm pulling all the strings. And frankly, it's racist and sexist. That's not the answer of an actual powerful person who's trying to lead the city. So the $50 billion thing was crazy to me. And it raises the point, which is they don't care about the costs of the demands. They care about how much they can extract from the city.
Do you think they know the number? Is there an answer to that question, Austin?
There's never an answer to that question, because the Chicago Public Schools spends around $29,000 per student per year. And when you ask anyone who says that that should be more, anyone who says there's been so much disinvestment, what the number should be, they never give an answer. It's like Stacey Davis Gates. It's like, ask another question, right? And guess what? If you give a number, you could probably sell that to a lot of people in Chicago. Say,
oh,
hey,
yeah, here's what we'll get for it. Yeah.
40,000, right? Just like we need to get to this number that is in some other school district.
Well, does anybody in the panel have much hope that Brandon Johnson will negotiate in the best interest of the aggressively as he can? I hear what you're saying, Austin, but I want to give the man a chance to prove otherwise.
I think he should be recusing himself from being the person who negotiates with them, but I haven't heard anything to the effect that he would. I did see something interesting. It was just kind of implied and talked about, but apparently CTU is proposing to have these negotiations be public if CPS also approves. There was a sentence, I think, in the Tribune article saying, for bargaining sessions to become public, Davis Gates added that CPS must also approve.
CTU has said that in the past. They want these things to be public. And guess what? I 100% agree with them. I think that would be great.
I would love to see that. That would be very interesting.
I was pretty much a fly on the wall for some negotiating sessions between Alt and Global Capital and the Tribune Newsroom Union, and they are so boring. And so, I mean, they just go on and on, and they take breaks all the time to confer with one another. You can make them public. I seem to remember a story, and I need
Austin
to reference
will watch
this.
Them. I mean, you know, we don't have to watch them.
Austin, we don't have to. But something happens in these. There was some district where they did this, where they had these negotiations in public, and it seemed to prompt a lot of grandstanding and a lot of hardening of positions where you couldn't give and take in the way that you would want to. I'm not sure it would result in better outcomes. I wouldn't mind it if they transcribed them so we would all get to listen later or something. But I just don't. And I guess that somebody somewhere along the line will say not to do that. But it's an answer to John Williams' earlier question, do I have confidence that Mayor Johnson will push back? I think he will push back a little bit, if only for show. And it may be that this is somewhat orchestrated or understood, that they will make some outlandish demand or some demand that seems way out of line, right? Such as, I mean, they're talking about subsidizing housing for teachers in Chicago, because if you live in Chicago, I've heard that was part of some of the talk in the air the other day. And they maybe they'll give on something like that. Like, well, Mayor Johnson, he put his foot down and there's no housing allowance for teachers in the city, something like that. But I think he will be quite aligned with him. I don't see them turning on him the way they turned on Mayor Lightfoot and the way they turned on Mayor Emanuel and Mayor Daley. I think they're going to be much more in lockstep. And again, this is, people will say, well, this is what we voted for. Without this tone that I'm talking about, this idea that we need to respect the taxpayers and people who are being asked to pay more, that this is a good investment for our city, this is necessary, that it's important, and it's to make that case rather than say, don't ask that question, next question. I think that is just really going to rub people the wrong way. And last time the teachers struck, they got a lot of support. I'm not sure they're going to get as much support under this if they strike again, or they threaten to strike again.
I don't think they'll threaten to strike. Stacey Davis Gates had a very interesting line in that speech where she said, we're not going to fight for what we need. Basically, we're just going to give students what they need, which means we got our guy in. So
I know.
We're not going to have to go in the streets anymore.
She should have literally brought strings with her, you know, and the little sticks. Yeah. And
I just want to say, I don't think it's racist or sexist to suggest that there's this great tie between this union and the mayor, and that the mayor and the union are somewhat in lockstep, and that they will answer to one another. I don't think anyone's saying that Stacey Davis Gates is doing the thinking for Brandon Johnson.
And she keeps saying this thing, and she phrases it in this way where she's like, everyone's saying he has no brains. He's really dumb. Like, no one's saying he has no brains. You're the one who brought it up.
No
one's asking a question saying, we think Brandon Johnson has no brains. Are you pulling the strings? No, they're asking, did you have an opinion on ShotSpotter? And was that taken seriously?
It's obviously deflecting from the basic always ask question, is this or that politician beholden to the people who put them in office financially? She's throwing it out there specifically to try and tamp down any discussion of it because people are afraid to be called racist. So that hopefully just gets the question off her plate.
Right. So if you do bring it up, therefore you are. John, you were shaking your head no to something. What were you disagreeing with?
No, I actually agree with a lot of this panel on this one. I think that for the most part, tit for tat, this has already been kind of figured out how they're going to do this. I agree with Eric about the back and forth to at least give the mayor something to say that he said no on. I was just going to say, I think Stacey Davis Gates needs to get off Twitter and X. She lives in that world. And she came after me once for a title of a podcast I had that literally was just, will school choice be going away in Chicago? She had actually listened to the podcast we did for Block Club Chicago. She'd find that the reporters were very fair in saying that people saying that it's going away completely were way wrong. I guess my ultimate point is she spends so much time fighting with people on X, and I'd rather her doing the job that she has.
I think she thinks that's her job to fight. I think, you know,
right,
like,
and she's got, and guess what? She does it not on X 10 times more. Like, that's the tip of the iceberg. And to John's point, though, about conducting yourself in a way that's in the best interest of the city, you are a extremely powerful public official in the city. She said in the speech, she really, 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 the question was essentially about how she takes care of her mental health. And she talked about the fact that her family was dragged into the debate about school choice, and that was totally crossing a boundary, a line. And I think we talked about this on this podcast.
Sure.
People will remember she was fighting to kill the Invest in Kids tax credit scholarship program, which allowed 9,000 low-income children to attend private schools by giving a tax break to donations to that program, while she herself was sending her child to a private school. And for one, Stacey Davis Gates has called out the children of other mayors for not attending Chicago public schools, and two, would often reference her own children as part of her bona fides to be able to talk about Chicago public schools. And she would often say, you know, as the mother of these Chicago public schools kids. So the minute she did not send her kid to a Chicago public school, then that was out of bounds. When you watch Stacey Davis Gates interact with hard questions like these, it's easy to see where Brandon Johnson got his communications training.
Since we're talking education, with the election of school board members and the appointment of school board members, Eric, what's the latest on that?
Well, the latest is that the Illinois Senate seems to have advanced the idea of having 10 elected school board members this fall, and then in two more years, they'll elect the last 10. And so that there will be 10 elected school board representatives and then 10 appointed by the mayor, and then the mayor will appoint the chairman of the school board. So there'll be essentially 11 to 10 mayoral appointees. And this assumes that, you know, some of the 10 also will be in line with or allies with the mayor. So he will definitely maintain control, no matter what, of the school board for the next couple of years, which will lead right to the 2027 election. Is that when the next? Yeah, 2027 will when he.
But after that, it would be all elected.
After that, it'll be all elected. And he was the one who was agitating for all elected. And Senate President Don Harmon said he was all in favor of an all-elected school board. But he was a champion then of this new idea, saying, well, the mayor wants it, so we're going to go along with that. Now, Harmon is from Oak Park. I don't know what skin he's got in the game, but he just folded like a noodle on this. I have no idea what was going on. And there were a bunch of Democrats who were just sort of saying, well, you know, we can't, we can't go against the mayor, and you know, let's let this happen, even though we think that it's a bad idea. And so they're going to have 10 districts, and then in 2 years, they're going to cut each of those districts in half. And if you believe in an elected school board, which I don't, but they do, then you just do it. It's the same thing with ShotSpotter. It's like if you believe something, if you don't like ShotSpotter, get rid of it. If you want an elected school board, have an elected school board. But this kind of creeping toward these solutions just seems crazy to me. And I don't know exactly what was going on, but they just seemed to fold to whatever Brandon Johnson wanted down in Springfield this week. And it looks like that's what's going to happen. They have a deadline of April 1st. Is that right, Austin? Or to finalize how this election is going to go in the fall, in November. So if you want to have an elected school board, have an elected school board, get the mayor out of it. But to have a sort of illusion of democracy by having, we'll have some people on the board be elected, but they won't have any controlling power because the controlling power belongs to the mayor. Like, what's that all about? Well, we know what it's about. We know it's the mayor has decided now that he's the mayor, that he wants to have control of the school board.
If the teacher's contract that gets negotiated this year is a lengthy one, then it's going to take a lot of decisions away from this elected school board once it actually finally gets up to all the members being elected. Not very right. Democratic.
It's heads you win, tails I lose. Mm-hmm. Or what's the other one? Heads I win, tails you lose. Yeah. they, if they're on both sides of the bargaining table, they're going to determine what the policies in the schools are before these elections even take place.
I think that's where we are today on the podcast. John had to click out a moment ago. We weren't able to get his review of this new movie he saw called Oppenheimer, but I had the feeling that he liked it. We sort of teased him enough last week about not having seen any of the movies that he went out and watched one. He went out and watched that Oppenheimer, and I think he liked it. But what's the maybe one movie, performance, actor, actress, or just movie in general that you're going to be rooting for on Sunday night?
I would go with Past Lives, easily Past Lives. The ones that were just, you know, giant blockbusters, Barbie, Oppenheimer, they were good in their own ways, but actually did not impress me as not anything like the way Past Lives did.
Oppenheimer's going to win, right? I mean, it's been cleaning up in all the other awards, I think.
Oh, okay. You're right. If that's been winning all the other
But the movie you like the most is more interesting to me, and the movie you like the most was Past Lives. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I would actually second that. I like Past Lives a lot. Now, I've not seen that many of them, but I really enjoyed that movie. And I got to say, I watched it because the people on this panel were so enthusiastic about it. I thought it was just a great experience. I just have one other opinion, and that is I did watch The Holdovers this last week, and it surprised me how much I liked it because the idea of the plot, you know, a teacher and student stranded at a boarding school over Christmas vacation. It sounded just formulaic. It sounded kind of John Hughes-y. I thought it was a very, very good film. I thought Oppenheimer was probably better overall. But Paul Giamatti in that lead role was just tremendous. And I would hope that he gets Best Actor. I haven't seen all the performances, but it was just a terrific performance.
I wish it was more John Hughes-y. That, as I've told you, the last couple of weeks was my least favorite of the 10. I thought Anatomy of the Fall had some of the best single performances that I saw this year. Past Lives was the one that I enjoyed watching the most. Poor Things was the craziest movie of them all. That was fun to watch. American Fiction surprised me for what it was. Wasn't so much or singularly about the racial issue, about black fiction and general fiction. It was about families and family dynamics, and I thought that was refreshing and pleasantly surprising. And I thought some of the best performances of the year were also in Killers of the Flower Moon. It was a big cast, but I think De Niro was really, really good in that. I saw somebody saying we may be overlooking the best performance of the year or the best performance of his career. And, man, what a son of a bitch he was in that. That was a good movie, too. So I've enjoyed watching them all. The only one I haven't caught up with yet, Eric, I didn't want to spend the $20 on it yet, was The Zone of Interest. But I'll have to go see that somehow or click on and watch that somehow.
I usually don't watch the Oscars. But I will say, there's a great fake movie review show that's been going on for, I like 10 to 15 years now called On Cinema at the Cinema. And they do an Oscar special every year. That's like one of my favorite things ever. It's great. So if you want to watch something very odd during the Oscars, that's pretty good.
You watch it during the Oscars? It's when it's on?
It's like a live stream that happens during Oscars, yeah.
But that's been ongoing series, right? That's a comedic series that's been going on for a while, right?
Forever. And one of the most famous things they did was a live, like 5 hour plus fake courtroom drama around one of the plot lines of the On Cinema at the Cinema show that is filmed so precisely like an actual court trial. That's like one of the most brilliant pieces of comedy
I've watched that. And you will go 40 minutes without a punchline or even a laugh. You just let my son sat me down and gave me the whole education and then made me watch a lot of that, Austin.
That is one of those. That's something everyone should try it. You should bail after about 60 seconds. And that is, it's also a classic thing that I could see people in college going to someone and saying, you gotta see this. And everyone just being like, wait, this sucks. I don't want to see this at all. But for some people, it's great.
Imagine Siskel and Ebert, they hate each other. And one of them doesn't want to even talk about the movies. He just wants to talk about his medical infirmities and his life. And he's obnoxious and boring and self-absorbed.
Okay. It reminds me of when Al Franken used to on Comedy Central a long time ago. Every time there'd be like a State of the Union address or a convention, it would be Al Franken and maybe one other person just kind of goofing on it during the whole thing. So you could watch the State of the Union address and just have Al Franken there throwing out all his jokes with whoever he was with. That was so great. I missed that.
Like the Mannings during a football game now. All right. Well, Kate, good to see and hear you. I'm watching you on the Zoom. Austin and Eric, too. John had to click out. But we appreciate everybody dialing in today. And I guess, Pete, I thought this was a Saturday night we're on the radio, but we're not, huh? Okay. All right. Well, thanks for listening into the podcast.
Maybe they could cancel whatever sporting event is going to be on. Put this on. I think this is going to be better, especially if it's the Blackhawks, because they really suck this year.
Hey, we won a game this week. We won a game. And the Connor Bedard card, the Connor Bedard trading card, the hockey cards like baseball cards, the new batch of cards dropped. It includes the Connor Bedard rookie card. And they say that's going to go for $1,000. So run to your bubblegum store, get your hockey cards, and get yourself a Connor Bedard, if you're lucky, rookie card, and you will get your that on the market will be worth $500 to $1,000, say the experts. Which is funny, because who knew that good old-fashioned cardboard bubblegum cards still have some sort of cachet? You know, they're not non-fungible tokens.
How long do we have to hang on to this Bedard card for this to happen?
I think you trade it right away, and maybe years from now it'll be worth enough to send your kid to college. Or maybe his career is a bust and it'll be worth nothing.
You could put it into Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin hit its all-time high the other day. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was going down the two. It was like down at 17 or something like that a couple years ago. And I thought, well, this is just going right down the drain. And then now it's up at 60-some.
We are produced by Pete Zimmerman and Ben Anderson. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
So I was at an event on last Thursday, and a guy came up to me, a young guy, Joel. He's like, love Mincing Rascals.
I got to start reading some of the email that we get, because it comes to me and Pete sometimes. And because, frankly, they have asked us to respond to some things, but often it's a week later and I don't even bring them in. But I will pitch at the beginning of the pod, send us your, email me, and I'll maybe we could address
questions,
it.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do an Ask Me Anything episode.
I'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
All right.
See you, kids.
Bye. Okay, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks, kid.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.